Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bexter, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hey, hey, or should I say bonjour, parce que je suis en France. Yep, I'm in Cannes, actually, for the evening. I've got a little gig here tonight. I was in Mexico on Monday, and then I got home on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at home. Today, flew this morning to Cannes, and back home tomorrow, and then I've got another gig tomorrow afternoon in London, and I'm going to take the kids to that, because it'd be really cute. I'm doing a festival called Foodies Festival, which I do a lot of in the summer, so that'd be nice. And this is, a little slice of glamour. It's actually really ridiculous in Cannes. I don't know much about the whole festival that goes on here, Cannes Film Festival, but I know it's been really busy here. Loads of people descended on Cannes, and our hotel seems to be sort of in the centre of everything. So when we got here, there was like red carpet and paparazzi and all this. Not interested in us, obviously, but it was all like one of those situations where you walk in and you think, oh, this is tiring, without even being my scene. I don't even know what's going on, I'm knackered. But the sky is blue, just had a nice lunch, got a little bit of time before I sing later, so I'm going to go for a little walk with Richard. I'm looking out the window as I talk to you, and the sea is twinkling at me. That's so nice. It looks beautiful. It's like kind of slipping into another world. I mean, it's not like normal life in Cannes, that's for sure. Anyway, the rest of the week's been really lovely. It's been quite busy. I've been a bit jet lagged. Wasn't really expecting it. I was only in Mexico for 3 nights, but I keep falling asleep at like 1:30 or 2 in the morning. Last night I went to sleep at 3, then up again at 6:30. It's not enough sleep, I tell you. I had an amazing time in Mexico. Such a brilliant trip, and loved Guadalajara, and then got back to delivery of my new album, Hannah. So I finally met it in person. Been signing lots of albums. So if you're one of the people who's ordered a signed one, well, thank you very much. I've done it myself and it's on its way to you. And yeah, feeling just generally pretty excited about things. I've done lots of interviews this week to talk about the record. And without sounding too enabling about the whole thing, I'm always very happy to do all of that stuff because I feel like it's such a lovely thing that people are still interested in what I'm up to. You know, there's loads of musicians out there. No one has to give me a time of day, so I do appreciate that. And it's been nice. I'm excited about the record, feeling good about the world. And for today's podcast chat, I'm actually taking us back in time because I spoke to Emma Dabbery back in March. I visited Margate for the first time to go and see Emma, but it wasn't the first time I'd met her. I sat next to her at a lunch I went to not so long ago, and I really liked her. I found her funny and smart and interesting and all the good stuff. She speaks very passionately about race. She grew up as a mixed race girl in Dublin. We're the same age, so all through the 80s, born in 79, I believe. She now has 2 little boys, lives in Margate, but she felt very other when she was growing up. She had a childhood partly in Dublin and partly in America. But when she was in Dublin, I feel like that's the place she would call home. And she loves being Irish, but she always felt very other, which is interesting because I've never had to think like that, really. I've never felt outside of, I don't know, how other people, I always saw versions of myself reflected at me as a child, and it must be very different if you don't. And it's prompted her to study and become an academic of the development of race and the politics that surround it. So lots of interesting stuff. She's written a couple of really interesting books, Don't Touch My Hair and What White People Can Do Next. So she's, you know, she really knows her stuff. Properly smart woman and interesting, and we had a great chat. It was the day after Mother's Day. I hope she won't mind me saying she was a little bit hungover in a good way, but she did say that at the time to me. So there was a couple of bits where I think both of us, I mean, I'm always like this anyway, but both of us kind of trying to find the right word. But she's way more articulate than me, so you don't need to worry about that. And yeah, it was lovely. And after we finished chatting, we went around an art gallery because one of our friends has an art gallery, and then we wandered around Margate. It's very lovely and I hope to go back. All right, I'm going to leave you in the safe hands of the chat with Emma and I, and I'll see you in the next one. Well, it's lovely to come to Margate today and find you here. Emma, how are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Actually, yeah, I'm happy that spring seems to be kind of like asserting itself vaguely-ish.
I always remember with March, they say, in like a lion, out like a lamb. In terms of the weather. And I think of it every year with March because it always starts and you're like, why am I still needing gloves and a hat? Mm-hmm. And then by the end, you've got buds, the days will be lighter, weather a bit warmer, a bit milder. I've seen some magnolia.
Beautiful.
It's on its way.
Yeah.
I've actually already read that you're quite into seasons. You like sort of seeing the chair. How are you with the transitional bits?
I think I'm okay with them. I've really made my peace with like living in this kind of climate. Mm-hmm. I think I used to be like really resistant to being from somewhere that was, come from Ireland. So obviously the climate is similar to here, but it's damper and wetter. And I used to be really like resistant to that being my reality, but I've really made my peace with it. Mm-hmm. And it's allowed me to actually like really appreciate the weather in this part of the world. I have a completely different relationship with it than I did growing up. There are still like some aberrations though, because I love that phrase that you, that saying that you just said, in like a lion, out like a lamb. Mm-hmm. But my birthday is like at the end of March. And I remember about 5 years ago, heavy, heavy snow.
Oh, yeah.
On my birthday. Mm. I was just like, what is happening? This is too much. I haven't made my peace with this.
That's taking the mickey, really, isn't it? I know, yeah. Well, my birthday's in early April, so mm-hmm. I share all of that with you. And I know that my husband's birthday, the 6th of April, we once had one of those crazy days where it snowed in the morning, and then we had a barbecue in the afternoon because the weather just sort of lifted. So I think, yeah, the weather can still throw you. But I have a really good friend who moved to Brighton, mm-hmm. and he said when you live near the sea, he said you don't really have, like, good days and bad days. Every day is just sort of weather, and it made him really enjoy that sort of spectacle. And now you find yourself by the sea, and I wondered if maybe that helps.
Yeah, I don't know if I have that same experience, because I feel like last summer here, I mean, last summer was just really, really hot across the board. But down here on the beach, it was like, it was insane. Like I would, you know, post a photograph and people would be like, and then I'd be like in London the next day and people would be like, oh, but I thought you were like abroad. And I was like, no, that's like literally just like the Kent coast.
Wow.
Like there were some like seriously, seriously hot days.
And yeah, it's true. And are you still swimming in the sea every day?
Not every day.
Okay.
But still regularly.
That's
good. And still, and I'm quite like, discipline's not the right word because I don't see it as something kind of punitive. but I realise that because of my schedule, like I can't get into the sea like regularly enough, I will make sure that I have like ice cold showers just to like keep me like kind of used
keep
to
that muscle flex.
Yeah. So it doesn't become something that I start to like be fearful of. You know,
that's actually pretty smart because I can imagine being warm is always quite nice. Don't get too comfortable with that.
I've had a few experiences like since I've started the cold water immersion where I've been somewhere and I can't access like hot water. So this is a freezing cold shower. And in the past, I would have been like, oh man, oh, I can't. Oh. But now I'm just like, oh, this is grand. Like, I can totally hack this. Yeah. Ice cold water, bring it on.
I'm very impressed, by the way. It's so far away from me, that ability. So I'm very impressed.
It's so far away from me traditionally. And I feel like if I can do it, like literally, like if I can be in cold water like that, anybody can be. Anyone.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know. Every time I hear this, I'm like, one day, I'll be inspired to do it. I kind of want to see what it's like. I'm actually a bit tempted. Did you see that program, the Wim Hof TV show, where he had celebrities and he took them, it's called Freeze the Fear. He took them and did like ice plunges and things. I actually was like, I would actually be interested in doing that just because I don't like it, but I could see that there's almost like a barrier with it. And I was like, maybe this would be quite good for me.
I think it would be really good for you. I did Wim Hof about, I did a workshop like about a month ago.
Okay.
In Cornwall, in this place called Three Mile Beach. And it was like, I did kind of like a condensed workshop. It was just in one day because I think usually they're maybe over a weekend or maybe a longer day. But it was... yeah, it was incredible. Like the breath work stuff isn't something that I normally like incorporate into like getting into the cold water, but I was kind of like introduced to all of that. I think a lot of the breath work is used in order to like mentally prepare yourself for immersion in the icy water. And I think one of the things that I was, I think something that I was doing though, kind of that I just felt... what's the word? I kind of inherently understood was something that I needed to do to be able to get into the cold water, was something that the breath work kind of helps you, not shortcut, but helps you get to another way, was I realized that I had to be like quite calm with it. Like when I first started preparing myself for getting into the sea, I started, it was before we'd moved, and I started just with cold showers, and the first week of those were like really painful. I actually felt like my skin was being like flayed or like burned, and I'd be like screaming, and I'd be like, you know, really tensing my body.
Yeah.
But after a week or so, I realized that really like that makes it a lot worse. So actually, if you don't tense, you don't scream, you just like let it happen. You're like, oh, a lot of the discomfort is actually coming from the way I'm like reacting to this. And I have like a lot more mental control over how it feels if I'm not so reactive. If I just let it happen and be like, you know, this isn't that bad.
Yeah.
Actually, it's kind of good. Oh, wow, it's kind of amazing. And then like, I don't know, it's just like a different headspace.
And but there's a lot about that. And that's like a metaphor for a lot of things, isn't it? With, you know, how you respond to stuff is so much part of your, for want of a better phrase, journey through it.
Mm-hmm, completely.
And sometimes you need to remind yourself of those things, because turning on your back and just sort of acceptance and letting it happen and acknowledging, but also not like tensing and panicking, is part of that whole thing. So I think there's a lot of really positive stuff in that just across the board generally. And before we started recording, you were saying you've had a really crazy year. So what else are you up to at the moment? What's happening with you in terms of work at the moment?
Yeah, so I'm working on a book that as of now shall not be named.
And this is your third book?
This is my third book.
And does it get easier, the book writing process? Or is it always the same sort of feeling when you're sitting down to write?
I think my circumstances have been really different with each book. So I don't know that it's easier. I don't know. It's just, it's different though, but I don't know if it's easier. I definitely find writing, people are like, oh, do you find it like a huge relief? Do you find it like really therapeutic? And I'm like, no, not in the process. In the process, I actually find it quite, I feel like quite under quite a lot of pressure, and I feel like I'm kind of resting like this stuff from like within me, and then trying to like put a aesthetic or whatever kind of form on it. So it actually feels like really labor intensive. And
I'm surprised anyone would think you would find it like a release, because the topics and the way that you're, as you say, structuring what you're talking about is weighty stuff. And so, I mean, obviously I'll talk about it in the introduction, but so your two books, one of which is very close to us, Don't Touch My Hair, and What White People Can Do Next. Mm-hmm. They're both, they center on the fact that you've studied Black history, degree, PhD. What you're talking about is huge, big stuff. And I did think that must be, yeah, I thought that must be a big pressure, but also it's all pretty serious, pretty deep, pretty huge. And, does the things like cold swimming and all this, does that help just give a place for you to go that's just kind of a release from actually the significance of what you're actually, the message you're actually imparting?
Yeah, I think so. I think definitely. I've been kind of committed to doing more like embodied practices, like more like physical practices, because I think I have historically like had a huge tendency to be like very like analytical, like, and very like intellectual, like very much in my head. And trying, I guess, to process things that I find, I feel like the word traumatic and trauma is overused, but that are traumatic. Trying to like, you know, approach them analytically and kind of feeling that if I can understand the mechanics of certain things, then I have kind of like agency or like power over them. But I feel that it's also, it can just be, it's also really important that you express things, or that you kind of remove, or that I remove the pressure from myself to always be in that really kind of like analytical space and do things that actually move emotions through my body in like more physical, in more physical ways. So this cold water swimming would definitely be part of that. Mm-hmm. And then also, I'm also writing a play, which opens, it's with like an Irish theatre company called This Is Pop Baby, and it opens in Dublin in October, and then we'll be coming to London to the Soho Theatre in like October of next year, October 2024. Mm-hmm. But with where we're at in the process of writing that now, is, well, actually, so this first book, Don't Touch My Hair, the director of the theatre company is somebody that I grew up with. And she read this book and she was just like, oh, you know, a lot of the biographical material in there could be adapted quite interestingly to the stage, to theatre. And then also because she knows me outside of my writing, she was just saying it was really interesting to know kind of deeper context of a lot of like what I'm saying in the book, because she's known me for so long. So anyway, I'm writing this play that has aspects of this book and the second book as well, and various other material in it. But the draft that we're on now, that both the director and the dramaturge that we're working with is like, okay, Emma, like no more theory. So they've given me, so I'm talking about my life, but then I'm like, you know, also like having all of this like theory and like analysis. And so that is going to be in there, but it's going to have to be like communicated in some other way. So like the next exercise they've given me is to just tell like six stories from my life.
Right.
But to just speak them, not to write them. Speak them, record them, not to write them, and not to like analyze them, and not to give these kind of like theoretical kind of like underpinnings that say, well, these kind of interpretations, to literally just like tell the fucking story. So I find stuff like that, quite challenging. So that's where I'm at now.
That's making me think, because when you were talking at first, I was thinking, actually, there'll be a lot of people who've gone very far down an academic path and really know their stuff, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a life they feel they live, and it's mm-hmm. connected so intrinsically. Mm-hmm. And maybe sometimes when you've been able to intellectualize and theorize and look back through, you know, and put things into context, maybe that's also been a little bit of armor that you've been able to put on, and now you're being asked to actually take that off and just be you and talk more from your own experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have to do that.
I feel like that is what's going on. But again, that's something that another reason I was kind of resistant to doing that is I think like for women, regardless of kind of like what their expertise is or what their profession is, they are often assumed to reveal like a lot about their personal life,
yes,
and their biography in a way that men, it's not that there's not expected of men in the same way.
God, that's so true.
So that also kind of like pissed me off.
Yeah, I totally get like, that. No. You're like, well, why does it have to have that strand to it? Why can't we not just listen to all this knowledge I have and the facts and what speaks for itself and the system we found, you know, existing? Why does it have to come back to me?
Yeah,
why does it have to have that motivation? But I suppose the way to feel better about that is to, what I would say is, as someone listening and receiving the information, is that for me, all my favourite communicators and teachers are people where at the heart of it, there's something about them that has that angle where it comes from another place. Because actually, that's what actually that human connection in the end ultimately makes the messages and the information so much easier to actually receive. And so that empathy.
Mm-hmm. To engage with. For it to be relatable and also for it to be narrative driven and like more compelling as well. Like I totally get that. I feel like I'm just kind of, and I do have like a lot of my life in like kind of most of the work that I do, but I also feel like I can be like quite a contrary person. And so if there's just like an expectation that because I'm XYZ, I will do this, I always want to do like the opposite.
Yeah, I know. I get that. I
override that, but I'm just saying it's there.
I think what you probably need to do is have it in your head for a bit and then come up with the way that you act. Now it's yours. You own it.
Yeah.
I'm doing it because this is the terms I'm doing it on.
Yeah.
I get that. But that's also like you've obviously always had a questioning mind. You're inquisitive and questioning, and then having to conform to an expectation is just not, that wouldn't have led you to where you're at, would it?
Yeah, I guess that's a good way of looking at it.
It's a nice thing. So if we talk for a little minute about motherhood, what was happening when you had your first baby in terms of what you're up to with your work?
So I was in the first year of my PhD, and I had done the first term of it, and then I realised that I was pregnant. So I finished that year, I did the first year, I had like insane nausea, not for the whole pregnancy, actually just for the first 3 months, but it was like completely debilitating. Like it was just like I was so sick. I'm somebody that's quite prone to nausea, and this was just like exacerbated to like, it was like, quite debilitating. But I did the first year pregnant. And then I was like, oh, I'll take like 3 months off and then I'll come back to it. And then after 3 months, I was just like, I breastfed like my son for like 2 years. So after 3 months, I was like, God, like he's still like completely like reliant on like breast milk. There's no way I can like go back to classes and studying. I was like, I'll do 6 months. And then at 6 months, I was like, no, there's no way, like... No, so I did a year. So I ended up like taking like a year off of the PhD when I'd only done a year of it. But it was at that time that I started blogging. That sounds like so archaic now. I started like, I guess because a lot of my PhD was also like based on, I was coming from a place of it not just being scholarship, but also trying to like kind of make sense of like the structures that have formed like my actual life.
Yeah.
So it was quite personal. I guess there was lots of stuff I was writing that wasn't suitable for the genre of writing that is my that is sociology. So I started kind of writing essays that I would put up like on Tumblr, and started kind of building like a readership like through that. And I went back to the PhD but kept kind of doing all that, which was like how I got a literary agent and like how the books kind of started. But yeah, that was the kind of landscape of what was going on when I was pregnant with my with my first son. I'm still doing the PhD. This is the final year I have to finish by.
That's pretty impressive. You kept it going.
Yeah, because I was really, I don't know, like so many people now, kind of like by halfway through it, were like, why the hell are you doing this? Like you're like successful, like you don't need the PhD. But I feel like because I committed like so much time and energy into it, that it's like important for me to like get the doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
And also there aren't that many black professors. They're not enough black knowledge creators and like academics in this country. So yeah, I feel like it's an important thing to do.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And do you think the process of becoming a mum made you think a lot more about some of the stuff you ended up writing about? Or were the strands of your books going to happen anyway, do you think?
No. Oh, of the books? No, I think... I don't see the books as necessarily related. Okay, actually, one thing that I think motherhood did give me, which would be relevant to the books, was like it actually helped me like focus and have like far more clarity in like what I wanted to and what I wanted to kind of like achieve, I guess, and like do with my life.
Well, because I wondered if, you know, you're thinking a little bit about the next generation, really, because sometimes when you come to have a child, it makes you think a little bit more about legacy, but also about the world that they're growing up in. So if you've got like a little fire in your belly of something to communicate, it can help focus that sometimes. Or give a little bit more of a kick to it.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I was thinking so much. I actually feel like I was kind of thinking, even before I had children, I feel like I was thinking about, not necessarily legacy, but like what I could do to kind of make things different, contribute to making things different to the way that they are, you know? I feel like when I hear about, I guess, young people who have a similar background to mine, specifically like in Ireland, and they're having like similar or even like more extreme experiences, I feel like very kind of, I don't know, like I feel like really, not protective, but I feel like this like compulsion, you know, to like do all that I can to kind of like contribute to like shifting attitudes. But it's also not even so specific as this idea of like only being concerned or moved by the experiences of people who have exactly the same identity as you is not really how I feel. I feel like one's own experiences of discrimination or whatever forms of, I guess, oppression or discrimination, those kind of things should also make you like more sensitive to groups who are experiencing discrimination or oppression or exploitation, even if they don't share like your particular identity.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I feel like it should kind of, yeah, make you more open to understanding, how oppression feels.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really love the way you speak about your topics as well, because sometimes you describe talking about race as quite icky, and I think that's such a brilliant word, because I think there's sometimes it can feel like there's all these like landmines and everybody's got these good intentions, but I think your second book and the articles you've written around it, for me, really I just feel like, why is it not more widely known that race is only such a relatively modern concept? Mm-hmm. 1661. I mean, I know it's not like super recent, but it's not that long ago.
It's
really
pretty recent.
I think it is pretty recent. Mm-hmm. And I think we're pretty much the same age. I'm 1979. Are you 1979? Yeah, so we're the same age. And I think it's really interesting, all the conversations that have got on. I don't know if you'd agree with me, but I do feel like the Black Lives Matter movement has actually made a shift. I do feel like something is different subsequent to that in how the conversations are going, and just the fact that they're happening so much more frequently. Mm-hmm. But what I found, for me, a personal sort of tricky thing was that when we were little, I felt like the emphasis was always on trying to not see skin colour and not see difference and all be kind of, we are all together as one and you can't see difference and don't recognise it. And then it's subsequently now, it's much more important to actually recognise it. Recognise that means a different thing, different. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like things are getting better? Do you feel like life is, the conversations are going in the right direction? It's clunky, isn't it, all this stuff? Because I suppose there's so much of these things are kind of steps forward and steps back.
Yeah. Gosh, there's lots in what
I know,
you said.
Sorry, there's so much going on there.
Not at all. I think the first thing of, like, so when I was growing up, I found that narrative of, like, we don't see colour actually, like, quite oppressive, because it was explicitly apparent to me that everybody very much did see colour and did see race.
Absolutely.
But then one was kind of not able to, if you addressed it, there was a kind of a narrative of, well, we don't see colour. So there was actually like no scope to really address. I felt like it was like this mechanism to actually kind of like shut you down if you tried to challenge what you were clearly experiencing. So I've never really been a proponent of that mentality in a context where it's more like lips. It's like more lip service. I didn't see it actually like manifesting itself in the way society was structured or in how people treated you or how people behaved. Today, however, though, one of the things I write about and what people can do next is when these conversations about race and specifically like about kind of black and white were, you know, there was so much attention being given to this topic, that seemed to me like a key moment where we would kind of mainstream the knowledge that you kind of hear race as a, so you did hear race as a social construct. I think that kind of phrase was something that became like popularized on social media, but it was kind of a bit like an empty mantra that people would say, but they don't really like know what it means. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, with so much attention on race and race being like so kind of high on the agenda, it was like a really like it was a moment where that invention of the idea of a white race and a black race, the kind of context for this phrase race as a social construct, could be mainstreamed. And rather than people reaffirming the concept of a white race and a black race as being these immutable categories, understanding that they were categories that were invented during the transatlantic slave trade for really nefarious purposes. They were like, the concept of a black race and a white race was invented in order to justify racism. So a concept that is invented to justify racism, digging more, becoming more entrenched in it as a natural way of just being,
yeah,
is highly unlikely to be a powerful tool of anti-racism, because yeah, its very invention is to justify racism. The necessity of justifying racism was born from the fact that all of these African people were being kidnapped from like West and Central Africa, and their labor was being exploited on these plantations. And the colonies, the English and other European colonies in the Americas and Caribbean, were becoming, you know, like obscenely wealthy because of this unremunerated labor. But also Europe was also becoming incredibly wealthy from all of this. So the economies were becoming increasingly dependent on this labor. But obviously it was like grotesque. In order to justify the use of people of African descent in this way, this idea of a black race as inferior was introduced, and then introduced through various legislation, and then spread throughout culture through various means. Actually, I was just looking at a game from the 1600s. From the 17th century,
mm-hmm.
from the mid-1600s, when the French are going to colonize Canada. And the game is, I can't remember the name of it, I only saw it for the first time recently. It's like a board game.
Mm-hmm.
So this board game was played in like homes, like it was really popular in France. And it was basically teaching the kind of hierarchy of race. French men were like the pinnacle. So when you get to the top of the board,
yeah, it's you're French, a French man.
What a coincidence. But the bottom was actually the native people of Canada, of that part of North America, at that historical moment. And that was part of it, this was part of normalizing killing them and stealing their lands, but popularized through like a family game. So I guess you look at like media and like all of these different kind of channels through which ideas about like racial hierarchies are disseminated and kind of entrenched. But yeah, I thought that the moment with the murder of George Floyd and the huge like uprising and Black Lives Matter was the moment where we could, you know, actually talk about these histories. That's one of the reasons that I wrote What White People Could Do Next. I just thought that historical context is so important, but was completely absent from most of the discourse that I was seeing,
yeah.
which was instead focusing on allyship. And it was allyship that I was saying, I think is quite an icky, a lot of the discourse around allyship makes me feel like really uncomfortable and I find it really patronizing, both to me and to like the potential ally.
No, I completely get that. And I think, I suppose with that conversation around racism, what people are imagining is about just stopping having any predisposed ideas about someone based on the colour of their skin and making sure, obviously, that there's also representation across the board. But what people aren't really thinking about is, as you say, the historical significance of what racism was, what its roots were, and how it became intrinsic to the whole way the economy worked, everything across the board. It became like completely how things had to be. You had to have that stay in your lane of everything to stop any coalitions between people who actually are in similar situations but aren't encouraged to see each other as peers.
Yeah.
So all of it. It goes throughout the whole system.
So that's really key, and actually something, yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's something that I'd like to just, I guess, like talk about for a moment. One of the other things that was happening in... You mentioned like 1661, and that's when these slave codes were drawn up in the English colony of Barbados. So these slave codes kind of introduced the idea of, you know, a black race, although the language used at the time wasn't black, it was a different word. But basically it kind of legislated that people who were of African descent would be denied like any access to protection under the law, and that Europeans, people who were becoming racialized as white, would have essentially like the power of life and death over this this other race. But one of the things that motivated that law was like this series of uprisings that had happened where like kidnapped Africans and like indentured Irish who were like working together on the plantations were also seeing the English landlords as like a common enemy. And those two groups combined, there were like much more of them than there were of the small kind of elite landlord class.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were coming together and like attacking the English and some Scottish landlords as well. One of the things that I found really fascinating about that period was the Scottish and the Irish and the English that were all in Barbados wouldn't have had any sense of themselves as having a shared identity as white people. They were from very different classes and they were also from very different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And they were kind of like, they were often like structurally like in, you know, in opposition to each other. There was no sense of, oh, we're all white and we have kind of like a shared fate and fortune. But one of the things that this slave code introduced was to start to give these legal rights to Europeans, people who were racialized as white, and started to kind of cultivate this sense of shared identity. So somebody like, so it kind of, it prevented, and to start to introduce this idea of, you know, this immutable difference between the indentured Irish and the enslaved Africans, whereas previously they would have seen their conditions as, you know, comparable in ways. It started to reinforce this idea of, no, you're distinctly different. And actually, for the Irish, you've got more in common with these other Europeans, even though they exploit you and they're like abusive to you. But you also have the opportunity to move up and to access what they have. And that happened for some for some of them, but obviously not for all of them. But it's kind of this carrot, like whiteness is this kind of carrot that is dangled. And you see that happening with kind of historical regularity. The next place that you see these slave codes introduced is in like, I think it's in Maryland. Is it Maryland? Virginia. Sorry, it's Virginia. And it's again, these indentured English and enslaved Africans come together and like fight the colonial elite,
mm-hmm.
these rich English lawmakers and plantation owners. And then they introduce these slave codes again. They kind of see what happened in Barbados, how effective and successful that was. And again, it kind of creates this distinct difference in like the law, but also in identity between these indentured English labourers and these enslaved Africans. And one of the kind of primary motivations in doing this is preventing those coalitions from emerging between them. And so in many ways, race was, the concept of the white race and the black race was introduced to prevent these class allegiances that were emerging, that were really threatening to the status quo.
That's powerful.
They're really threatening to, I guess today it would be the 1%.
Yeah.
And so you still see the same process happening like time and time again.
Yes.
And kind of immigrants or just marginalized or minoritized identity groups being scapegoated when the abuse of power is really coming from like, you know, like the 1%.
I know.
But people can be distracted from focusing their attention on that, and they can be distracted by thinking about like migrants or refugees or black people or Muslims or you know, whoever it is, when actually like the source of the exploitation and oppression and inequality and poverty is actually coming from
all the same.
Yeah.
I know.
Coming from the 1%.
God, that's so true. And terrifying actually when you think of it. And actually on the way here on the train, I was reading an article about wokeness and how that as a term as well stops people wanting to put their head above the parapet to question, because it's become a kind of an ugly term for anything that's trying to look outside of your own lane again, isn't it? It's like just the idea of kind of like trying to join dots is like, oh, careful. Are you actually doing something that's pretty uncool there? It's a pretty toxic thing in total, isn't it? And it's terrifying that all those things we're talking about, the immigration, that's all present day. That's literally where we're at.
Yeah, completely.
It's just like head in hands. sort of stuff. And so I'm picturing, by the way, I think you're considering, you told me just before we started, you've got a little bit, tiny bit of a hangover. You're incredibly eloquent. Emma, it's amazing. I'm thinking back to like us as teenagers. So you're in Dublin, I guess, in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. So at what stage were you at there with your quest for information, your go towards academia? Was that something that was always there as the kernel from the get-go?
Well, I always read. Like, I was always, like, a really... Like, I was always reading a lot from, like, a really young age.
Is that in your family too, your mum and your dad? Is it the same sort of thing?
Yeah, very much with my dad. But he... My parents separated when I was, like, 8. So he wasn't necessarily like an immediate influence in that way. Mm-hmm. But actually, even when he left and went back to Nigeria, all of his books were still in the house. And a lot of them were, he'd studied like English literature. So there was just a lot of like Faulkner. There was a lot of just like English, actually like American literature was kind of what his preference was. But he was also really interested in like Cuba. So like, I remember like one of the first books he gave me was like a young person's like manifesto on Cuba. So it was all like about Fidel Castro, but it was like for children. And then I remember books like, there's a really classic book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, by Walter Rodney. And I wasn't like reading that when I was a small child, but it was in my house. So I just remember the spine said how Europe underdeveloped Africa, you know, so that these ideas are kind of being introduced to me. But I feel like because I was born in Ireland and then we moved to the States, where I was in like a very black environment, like with my Nigerian extended family in like a very black part of America as well. And then we moved back to Ireland, which couldn't have been like more the as white as could. I kind of went from it being as black as it could be to it being as white as could be, like just really like quite starkly, extremely different. And I never thought about race in the American and Nigerian extended family context. I only started thinking about race when I came back. To Ireland. And I guess I was kind of like looking for answers, I guess, as to try and like kind of make sense of why, like what was happening to me was happening. So I think through that, I was like just reading like a lot of like black history books. And
when you say what was happening to you, what do you mean by that? Do you mean you were feeling
or
things
quite like a lot of like explicit racism. Like in those days, this is like in the 80s, there was like very, very little difference like in Ireland. Like even things like if you had an English surname, like you'd really stand out. Like it was just like 99.9% obviously like white, but like also like Catholic and very, very socially conservative. Like anything that was a little bit different was like a big deal and often met with hostility and suspicion. So I was like more than like a little bit different. Like I really, really stood out. And I feel that it was interesting because there was an absence of black people, but there was a presence of very stereotypical notions about black people that had just been, you know, imported from other parts of the world. And were just really, you know, what's the word, like really prevalent in kind of mainstream and popular culture. And also the fact that in Ireland, so I'm really fascinated like by Irish history and that the kind of like complexity and the paradox in Ireland, whereby it's the country that was colonized by Britain longer than anywhere else. Like it's like mm-hmm. 800 years. And it had that decimation of tradition and destruction of language, and so much of that, like just violence and oppression of colonialism, and that Ireland shares with other colonized countries, and it has like the longest kind of history of it. But what distinguishes Ireland in comparison to the other colonized countries is Irish people came to be racialized as white people. So there's this paradox of being having access to whiteness, but also coming from a culture that has been like brutally oppressed and a state that has been, you know, like colonized for centuries. But I feel like in that relationship of Irish people being racialized as white, when you go back to the invention of race, whiteness and blackness exist or were created as the mirror kind of binary polars to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a context where people are racialized as white, even if there's not many black people in that context,
mm-hmm.
there's still this inherent sense of superiority that is taught with being racialized as white. Do you know what I mean? So that was still present. So I was just trying to make sense of this as a young child.
Yeah.
And I guess I kind of looked for the answers in books. So I read a lot of, black history. But I also feel like, and I read a lot of black fiction as well. And I always find it really interesting that, you know, people talk about like representation, like in books. I always was able to access lots of books that had black protagonists for children. I've since found out, though, that one of the bookshops that I frequented regularly, called Books Upstairs, was actually like a really radical bookshop, which I didn't realise when I was a child. So it had all of these books that were from small, like kind of like radical presses, and it had like a lot of like queer literature and like black literature and just all of this. It was just like a super, super progressive bookshop, but I didn't realize that. So I guess that's also how I found like lots of the books. And when I was really little, my mom sold like vintage clothes, and my younger siblings went to like nursery, but because I was older, I just would go with her, and I'd just sit in the bookshop all day waiting for her to finish work. So I feel like my education kind of came from there. So that answer was so rambling.
No, I love it, because actually I think that books can be a very quiet but powerful rebellion, because it's almost like you read and you read and you read and you build and you build and you build all these other voices, all these other spaces you can go in your head, and it's like under the radar. I think it's...
Yeah.
Books are amazing like
They're
that.
They're so amazing.
And I wonder what it was like for your mum, though, when you're experiencing that, and, you know, the idea of raising a child that you can see is having negativity because of how they look, or the fact that they don't look the same as all the other kids at in playground. That must have been heartbreaking. Was she aware, maybe? I don't know.
She was aware, and she would... there was a group that I was part of called Harmony, which was like, it was like a group for like Irish people that like weren't, I guess, that weren't white. And there were like a handful of like other people that I knew who had like Ireland. Yeah, it was just so kind of like not diverse. But this group was like, I feel like anyone that had like kind of one not white parent, like probably like a black parent. I think there were maybe, I'm trying to think, was there even anybody who had like, maybe there was like one person that had like an Asian parent or something. There was not many of us, you know. There was this group, and I can't really remember. I think we'd kind of like do activities and stuff. But it was still like an environment where if I like saw another, like if I saw another black person, I'd be like, wow, like, you know, it was like a big deal. It was like an event. But she was friends with like a few other women who also had like, you know, children whose dads were, I think most of their dads were like African. And she'd also, she'd like take me to, London to like get my hair done and stuff, because in those days there was just not
hairdressers there, and in the way that you can buy products like online, or you could watch like a YouTube tutorial or whatever, like that was just not, there was not access to stuff like that.
It's like we grew up in such a different time.
When I try and explain to people, I feel like if you, unless you had direct access to like knowledge and information and products, they just didn't, that was it. Like, you know,
we had four TV channels. You watched what was on at the time.
It's another world.
It is.
So I remember my mum taking me to like Tottenham to get my hair done, taking me to like Moss Side in Manchester to like get my hair done. I got like a jerry curl. This was like the early 90s. She would like make like an effort, you know, but there wasn't really that much she could do. We were just in this environment that like was what it was. And I feel like I actually felt like quite a lot of anger towards my parents, because I was just like, also because there were like so few non-white or black people there, I was just like, I'm like, how is it me? How have I been the person that's ended up having this experience? Like, this is like, it felt like a unique form of punishment. And also, we'd come from this environment that was like a mostly black environment. And with the exception of my mum, kind of my whole like social world had been black, and I just hadn't had any of these experiences. And I was like, why didn't we just stay there, you know, where I was like not subject to all the things that I experienced from like at a young age in Ireland. So I actually felt quite angry, I think, with my parents. Like, in hindsight, I see that my mum, we kind of had to, like, we were in America through my dad, and he didn't want to stay there. So my mum kind of had to go back to Ireland. Like, do you know what I mean? There was nowhere else that she could go, really. I mean, I guess we could have gone to Nigeria, but I don't even know if that was like an option then. I don't know. I used to feel as well like I wouldn't be able to like raise children in Ireland because, I love Ireland, like really, like a great deal. If you follow me, you probably like hear me like talking about Ireland like quite a lot. And I love Irish culture. I really miss Irish culture, like living here. At the same time, the reality of what I experienced, like because of racism growing up, I was like, I just wouldn't subject my children to that. Like, I just would just rather like not live there. I now feel that like the country has changed. The country has actually also changed like dramatically.
It really has.
It's changed to a point where I actually feel like I could live there with them and it would be grand. And I guess I'm saying this maybe not as enthusiastically as I would have said a few months ago, just because there's been a few incidents recently where people have told me about people who have children who are not white have told me stories that seem very, very similar to the kind of things I experienced growing up. And I have been like shocked and appalled to hear that is still happening. It's still happening to people. And that has just, I have to say, like when I go back home with my kids, like their presence in the spaces that we're in, their presence doesn't provoke any kind of reaction in the way that mine did. No one really gives them a second look. So on the basis of that, and there's lots of different types of people, you know, kind of from all over the world. So on the basis of my experiences when I go home, I feel like it would be fine. But I have recently just had parents telling me about things that their children have experienced recently that give me pause. They give me pause for thought.
I mean, do you feel like your boys are growing up in a very different, their childhood is very different to yours, full stop?
Yeah, their childhood is hugely different to mine. But like at the same time, like even though I was like quite angry with my parents for us leaving America and then bringing me to this like super, super, super white environment where I was seen as like an aberration, I'm still like, I'm really glad that I grew up in Ireland, like that I'm Irish. Like I feel like
my Irishness is kind of like an anchor, or like it's just something that like I get a lot of like succor. Is that the word? Succor. I don't know.
But I think it's fascinating as well how quite often the things we really like about when we're young end up becoming really defining.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that, you know, when you find yourself an academic, like when, again, before we start recording and I said about my mum writing books and you were like, I always thought books were something you did when you're older, but obviously you've done it, you know, in your 30s. And, you know, sometimes knowing what it feels like to be the one that's have a sense of other actually can be a bit of a superpower if you choose to take that on. And like I was thinking, there must be a lot of people, if they sit down next to you somewhere and have no idea that you've got all this knowledge, all this powerful stuff. And I mean, have you ever had that where someone's having quite a, just a chat with you and then you're actually able to be like, well, I really do know. Like, let me take you back through time. That's amazing. Like, I think that must be like a, yeah, like a really cool kind of invisible weapon.
That's such a funny question, because that actually does happen quite a lot. Like, I'll like sit next to somebody and we'll get like deep into things and they'll be like, afterwards, they'll be like, I just did not expect to have that conversation with you. I just did not expect that. That happens frequently.
Well, that's cool. And you've spoken as well, you know, I saw recently a post about, you know, femininity and, you know, being an intellectual who can still celebrate fashion and the way you look and all that stuff. And I think, yeah, there's just, I think all that stuff becomes really powerful. I think it's brilliant. Why should there be an expected path if you're going to be able to be, have serious discourse? You can also still appreciate aesthetic. Like, it's all there for the taking. I think it's all good.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think things that are read as feminine are also read as like silly and superficial and shallow. Like, I can be like quite giddy and I can be like quite giggly, and those things are often immediately read as like, well, you're kind of feminine and not a serious person. And I'm like, no, but I can be those things and also be like a serious person. And also in my books, like, I try and use, well, I don't even try, I think this is just like how I express myself in the written word. Like, I might say this, you'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? They're not funny at all. But quite a few people have said to me, oh, I was surprised by like the humor in your books. They were like, there was a few times that I was like laughing and I was just like, shit, am I like meant to be laughing? Because this is like actually like quite disturbing material. But like, so I do feel like I feel that's another thing. Like, if you're dealing in ideas or like academia, there's also kind of sometimes meant to be no personality or like no humor.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise it's not serious. And I think what some of the most powerful ways of actually conveying things that are serious is through utilizing humor.
100%. Yeah, massively agree with that.
Yeah.
Mm. So back to your boys, what are your hopes for them and their future? I know it's a really big question, but it's something you've clearly, you know, would have thought about a lot, I'm sure.
Yeah, I just, gosh, I honestly just want them to like be, like to feel secure and to be happy with their lives. Obviously, happiness is not like a consistent emotion that one, you know, kind of always like that one always feels. But yeah, I would just want them to be like kind of contented and satisfied with their lives, and to do like, I also don't care like what they do in terms of like their professions. Like, it could be from, I don't know, like science to acting to sports. Like, it just could be anything. Like, I don't care. Just as long as like they are, like they enjoy it and they feel satisfied with what they're doing. And then for me to just be as supportive of them, whatever they do with their lives, like as I can be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it.
That's a wonderful thing. That's a good thing. Well, I was thinking, because like when you said about the books you would read when you were young and how it turned out as a radical bookshop, and I'm thinking now it's lovely that you've written your books that sit in high street shop bookshops. Like, things definitely have come on hugely, that it's just not radical to talk about these things anymore, is it? And I think, I mean, do you think about the fact that there might be like a version, like, the, you know, a marginalized teenager who finds your book and then that becomes the thing that makes them feel like, aha, there's a way to deconstruct and then actually change things?
Oh, yeah. Blowing my own trumpet, but I have had countless people like message me and just be like, there's a part in the book where I talk about reading Frantz Fanon, who's like this post-colonial theorist who wrote these two kind of like seminal books in the 1960s called Black Skins, White Masks and The Wretched of the Earth. And I talk about in my degree, like doing African studies and reading Black Skins, White Masks, and just the sense of like relief I felt encountering like Fanon's work when I was like 19. And then I had people being like, oh, when I was reading you talking about that, and I was thinking, well, that's what this book is like doing for me. And I was like, oh my God. So yeah, that's like And I've also had like people in Ireland as well being like, oh, you know, reading about you saying you didn't really have anyone that was similar to you that you could kind of look to, and then being like, well, I would have felt like that, but I have you. Not that I'm saying, like, I just want to say, I'm never telling anybody what they should think. Like, I hate discourse, and like, there's so much of it in our current moment that doesn't encourage like critical thinking. It actually just encourages or demands. It demands that you just kind of parrot a script. There are certain things you have to think like me, and you have to think like this, or you're problematic. And I'm honestly never telling anybody what they should think. I would really just want to encourage like critical thinking, so I can like kind of present ideas to people and they can really like give or take them. Do you know what I mean? I'm not like, if you don't think like me or believe what I say, then you're toxic, or you're like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying, I wouldn't see myself as a, I guess that's kind of different to being a role model, but yeah, I'm never telling people what they should think or what they should say. I'm just presenting them with maybe like alternative ways of thinking and alternative sets of information that they might not be easily able to access elsewhere.
Yeah. And I can see that. And in a personal way, when you said when you were growing up and you experienced racism, is that something that is still part of your life? Is that something that you still experience now?
Like, definitely. But I feel like a lot of the narrative around racism, how we talk about what is and what isn't racism now, is very, but so I grew up just, you know, with like countless like microaggressions, people would call them now. I wouldn't have used that vocabulary at all. I still don't really use that vocabulary, but just like for the sake of a succinct answer, let me say that. So I just grew up with that just being the kind of pervasive, like, kind of background. But then also, you know, like certain treatment in school, I guess school was like the primary institution that was kind of like, shaping my life as a child and a teenager. Very different treatment in school to my peers, which, you know, stemmed from my teacher's perceptions about Black people. But I just feel like so much of the bandwidth of our discourse around racism gets caught up in these very interpersonal exchanges, which, you know, can have like a profoundly negative effect on one's life. And I'm not by any means saying they're irrelevant. They're not at all. But I think we also, you hear people talk about, oh, structural racism, but then we don't really, I think, often engage with like what that, with kind of like state and institutional racism. And a lot of our focus is often on just those interpersonal exchanges.
Right. Okay.
So I still have those, yes. Like, yeah, I still have those to varying degrees in different places.
Mm-hmm.
Like, things are different in Ireland to how they are in England, to how they are in the US. It also really frustrates me when we conflate how racism operates in those different English-speaking parts of the world, because I've lived in all of them and it is actually like very, very different. But I think it's really important that we... we look at the way race and class intersect, and like when you are okay. So I read this interview with the people who grew up with George Floyd, you know, whose murder it was that sparked this like current movement, and they were talking about for how black people. So George Floyd grew up in some, I actually can't remember what part of America he's from, but he grew up in like a projects, like in a very, very, you know, underprivileged environment with very, very entrenched intergenerational poverty. And I think it was one of the people he grew up with saying that like for all of this attention and all of this like focus for black people who live in the area where he grew up, like very little has actually changed. So like our focus, you know, is so much on diversity and like casting diverse models and all of these things that are just quite like don't actually transform society in the necessary ways that would give people people whose backgrounds are like George Floyd actually access to the opportunities and quality of
social
life,
social mobility, and all those
exactly
things.
That they deserve. I feel like so much of the discourse just ends up being around. Actually, there's this amazing book by a Nigerian American philosopher, Elite Capture, how the powerful took over identity politics and everything else, something like that. But it's called Elite Capture is the main title, and he's talking about how the concerns of marginalized groups, what we've kind of seen happen is it is often, he's talking about elites, but he's not talking about traditional elites. He's talking about the elites of marginalized groups. Mm-hmm. So people within marginalized groups who have relative power in their groups and access, and how they all often make the concerns that are seen as representing that group about things that will be beneficial to them personally as individuals. But remember that they're people who, while they exist in this marginalized group, they are the elite of that group. Yeah. So the concerns, what the public sees as being the concerns of that group, often we see this on social media all the time, do not represent that group. They represent the aspirations of the elite in that group.
Now that makes total sense.
So the actual like really entrenched structural like poverty inequality is not ever really being tackled with, but maybe more superficial and shallow concerns are. And it's a very nuanced argument that he's making, but it's so important. I feel like everybody should read that book, Elite Capture.
Yes. That sounds well, I guess as well that goes back to your ideas of how actually it's a restructuring that's needed, not just because it's all very well and good to say for, you know, a little girl growing up in a black community and she sees on TV a black actress and that gives her, oh, that could be me. And, but actually what you're looking for there is for a tiny, tiny percentage of people to have sort of somehow superseded where they're at, gone above and beyond, be amazing at acting, be amazing at sport, go to the next level.
Yeah.
Otherwise you don't be anywhere.
You're actually
asking them to be superhuman or stay unseen. So actually, if you haven't got the bit where you're actually giving day-to-day difference, it's not really going to make any big changes.
Exactly. And I feel those changes like are not happening. All that's actually happening really is there's like a massive redistribution of wealth that is like increasing the power and wealth of the 1%. So I kind of think things are actually getting worse. And then we're also like hurtling towards the earth overheating to the point where it can't sustain life, which is all part of the same process of system of, extraction and exploitation and the concerns of the concerns of like the ruling class who are just, you know, like so kind of myopic and short-termist and just about amassing and hoarding as much wealth as they can in their kind of like immediate future, but through which they perpetuate systems that, you know, further racism and misogyny, but also actually like are destroying the earth itself. But it's all about kind of like short-term gain for them.
It's not making me feel cheery, Emma.
Within all of that, okay. So this, okay. No, but I have a solution. Okay, I have. Okay, there is a solution.
Is it alcohol?
That's one of them. But again, that's a short-termist. No, the solution I truly believe is the creation of like coalitions. Mm-hmm. So people often think solidarity is like actually, or just trying to placate one group, or just being like real like fucking like kumbaya, let's all hold hands. But like, I actually think that is fully, it's the opposite of that. I think solidarity is more difficult to achieve and it's more subversive. And so many structures have been put in place to prevent the emergence of solidarity, because solidarity is really, really threatening to the 1%, to the status quo. I just think it's like, it's of crucial importance. I think the only way that we can create like mass movements that are powerful enough to transform the material conditions of society is through creating like coalitions where most of the world can see that their lives would be improved by transforming things, even if their struggles are slightly different to those of their neighbours. The importance of like, cultivating solidarity and working together, creating coalitions.
No, that makes total sense, and it does actually leave me with a modicum of optimism after crushing.
Sorry.
Crushing.
I was like, let me wheel that back.
Okay, that's good to know there's something. I've only got one last question for you, and it's just a practical one, actually, because I was thinking about your, I suppose, what you'd call your day job with the, would you call your main job the writing?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you do that with young children?
I have like a room.
A soundproof like room.
No, it's not. It's far from soundproof. I have an office at
it's
home.
It's got six bolts. And then my
it's an underground bunker. No, they're in school and nursery. So I just like work during the day while they're there.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Because I was writing a book once, not a like a proper book, because it was only a book about me, which is like a lot easier to write. I recommend that, by the way. You chose from sole topic, me. But I would just go upstairs, but I would have the door open, and it's all during lockdown, so they weren't out of the house. It was quite challenging. But if you're able to keep to those hours, I guess, so you're not someone who suddenly finds you need to write at like 6 p.m. through to midnight.
Oh, no, I totally am. And then like I kind of like can't, so I just...
You just can't?
Yeah, I might try to, but yeah, no, it is quite difficult to balance. And the second book that I wrote in lockdown, in like... we lived in Hackney and we had like just an open plan space. Like, so I was just there like with my kids because they were there too. And my husband, and we were just all there. And it was like, actually, like I do know how I wrote the book, because people are like, how did you write it in those circumstances? Because I can have like hyper focus where I'm just like, you know, like in the thing. But yeah, it definitely wasn't the ideal like circumstances to be writing it. And I hear about people like, you know, like kind of writing, they like go to Bali on their own for like kind of like 2 months.
Even just
like
a cafe. Just not to be Bali.
And I'm like, no.
I picture you like, you know, those thing where they speed it up, but there's you on a laptop and around you there's like kids and people and things being moved. And
were you there? That's what it was like. Chaos.
Yeah. Well, extra well done then.
Why is it actually spicy?
They're spicy? Hi, I'm home. Oh, Jesse just tried a packet of crisps that we brought back from Mexico. Are they spicy or not?
No.
Okay.
Missy just think they're a little bit spicy.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Sorry, no. I've started recording this in the middle of, just family time. But Richard needs to take his computer to go and get it fixed, so I've got to be quick talking to you. These are the things we think about. I've just got back from Cannes. When I did the intro, I was still there with the twinkling sea. I'm now actually in my very sunny garden. God, it's gorgeous today. We thought we were going to have a really horrible flight home, but it actually turned out all right because... Sorry, I'm shutting a gate. There you go. Because they had no passport gates working. The e-gates weren't working. But by the time we got to Heathrow, it was probably about half an hour. We'd been looking online and there were reports of it taking like 3 hours. Actually, in the end, it was all right. Hello, Jessie, what is it?
I am coming.
You are going. Okay, yeah. Perfect. Did I tell you on that note about last week when I was flying to Mexico and I ended up sleeping a night in Dallas Airport? You know, I'd always looked at people who were sleeping in airports and felt a bit sorry for them. And then at age 44, found myself... if you're ever in Dallas Airport, D23, gate D23 has got some lie-down beds. I can't guarantee there won't be any construction work. Do you want me to open these, Mickey? These look spicy as well.
Yeah.
We brought back crisps from Mexico and the kids have just found them in our bag. Churumais. Lemonjito. They look good. It's a pretty bag, isn't it? Anyway, how lovely was Emma? Sorry about the distraction.
Open it.
I will open it. Hold on. There you go. Not only, I mean, Emma has the most lovely accent, by the way. How nice was that in your ears for a little while? But what I love about her, and I liked it when I said to her, you know, do you ever find you sit next to somebody or you meet somebody and then they're a bit wowed by all this information you have in your head and how far you've taken your academia with, you know, she really knows her stuff. And she was like, yes, that does happen to me all the time. I thought, I bet. It's like a secret weapon, isn't it?
Mommy.
Knowledge. Knowledge is power and all that. Anyway, I think I'm going to have to... Oh, these are spicy as well. Sorry, Dan. Do you want some milk?
Yeah.
God, the children in Mexico must be able to cope with very spicy crisps. Not so the Jones boys. Anyway, thank you so much for this week. Sorry it's a bit of a hush. I was supposed to be back hours ago. Everything went a bit wonky, but life is good. I'm back home. Oh, those are nice flowers. Some nice flowers for me on the side. Oh, pretty. And I've got another festival this afternoon. I'm off to sing for Foodies Festival in Sion Park. And then I actually just booked another podcast guest on the way home. I messaged someone and she said yes. More of that to follow. And we're not far off the 100th episode. That's exciting, isn't it? God, it's so noisy in here. So this must be horribly ears. Thank you so much for joining me. Thanks to producer Claire, editor Richard, artwork by Ella May, mostly you, being so lovely. And of course, my beautiful guest, Emma Dubby. See you next week. Bye-bye.